Good morning. We're in business.
Hopefully.
Is it almost exactly 10 years ago today that Jishu Roshi suffered a massive heart attack in Santa Fe? Just after she and Bernie had moved out there. It's actually unpacking, emptying boxes when she had the heart attack. And some of those boxes still haven't been unpacked. She died 1 week later, on March 21st. In the hospital in Albuquerque where they had moved her. So this is a good, very good time to be remembering her and talking about her. It's very, very sudden. And unexpected, this heart attack, although her health had always been compromised. She'd had polio as a child. A few years earlier, she'd had a massive stroke, which left her almost totally paralyzed for a period of time, but she recovered almost entirely from that. There were a few things which continued to bother her. She loved to sew and she couldn't thread a needle anymore. But for the most part, she was really back. So as you know, she was one of my four wonderful Zen teachers. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her today, and I think I'll probably talk about her again in the near future. There's a little bit more that I want to say about her, need to say about her, want you to hear about her. And I can do in one talk. She may actually be the only genuinely humble person that I've ever known. And at the time that I met her, she was probably the first genuinely humble person for sure that I'd ever known. And the truth is that I didn't have a clue as to what humility was until I met her. I thought, and this is the truth, I thought that humility was kind of a tactic. That if you didn't want people to think that you were a know-it-all or arrogant, that you would put on this, you'd act like, well, I don't really know, can you help me? And then maybe, people wouldn't kill you. Sort of like, that dog behavior, wolf behavior, when you meet a dominant wolf and you're a less dominant wolf, you kind of lie down and bare your throat like that. And that's like, looks like humility, but it's more like, don't kill me, please. For Jishu, her humility was not a tactic. It wasn't It wasn't a behavior. It's who she was. And, you know, perhaps, not surprisingly, I think about it, talk about her here at Mount Manresa, you know, talk about humility, we think about Jesus, perhaps. And of course, that is that was an example of humility as well. And what's sort of not so remarkable, perhaps, for those of you who grew up with Jesus, that was remarkable to me, was not only was humility not a tactic, it didn't work as a tactic. Not only did Jishu not act humble in order to get other people to do what she wanted them to do, she was just humble. And more often than not, they didn't do what she wanted them to do. Now, if you think of it in terms of Jesus, and you think of it in terms of ending up on the cross, then that doesn't come as a big surprise. But to someone who thought of humility as a tactic for gaining cooperation, this came as a kind of a surprise. And she suffered for it. People didn't always treat her well, even in the context of Greyston. Even in a situation in which she was married to Bernie Roshi, you know, who was definitely the big cheese. You would have thought, perhaps, that people would have treated Jishu with respect just because she was his wife. Maybe it was because she was so humble. You know, she was so humble that people thought they didn't have to treat her with respect even though she was Bernie's wife. So I knew working with her that I had to learn something about humility. I was reading Thomas Merton's journals during those years, and he worked a lot on humility. I used to go to Jishu periodically and say, you know, I've been working on humility now a couple of years or a couple of years more, whatever it was. Don't you think I can go on to something else now? And she would just smile. When I first met her, she hadn't received transmission yet. She was a Dharma holder. She didn't have any sensei yet. She was one of two Dharma holders who were pretty actively teaching at the Zen community of New York in Yonkers, Nancy Mujo Baker, who some of you may have met, or will meet, was the other. But everybody there kind of circled around Bernie. Nobody called him Bernie in those days. He was sensei in those days. Everybody kind of circled around him. You were up there for a little while, and you kind of naturally began to look for, you know, what you could do to give back. Well, what could I do for Bernie? And there are a lot of people who've been around there years and years before I got there. They were all in line to do things for Bernie. Like if you wanted to carry Bernie's suitcases for him to the car or something, there were always a line of other students, more senior, waiting to carry his suitcases. I don't remember what the sequence of events was up there in terms of some of the things that happened to me. At some point, they asked me to be the president of the board, and I became the president of the board. At another point, Jishu asked me to become a member of the Zen community of New York. They had a little bit of some rituals that surrounded that, including doing an all-day sitting basically by yourself. There was a zendo there, and there was a lot of other things going on in Grayston in those days. And some people would come and sit on their way into work in the morning, and some people who worked there would come and sit for a period after eating lunch. But you know, I came up there to do my 12-hour sitting, so I was going to sit from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, and I brought my lunch. Jishu had asked me to become a member. Part of the other thing of becoming a member was that you got a robe, a layperson's robe. There was a ceremony where they would sense the robe, and you'd get this robe, and I never wanted to do that. I never wanted that robe because it seemed to me that the robe created this difference between the members and other people who were there who weren't members, like an in-group and an out-group, and I didn't want to be in the in-group. But Jishu asked me to do it, and because she asked me to do it, I said I would do it. I had taken some classes with her. I liked her a lot. I was a student of Bernie's. Maybe I was the president of CCNY by then. So she asked me to do this, and I said, okay, I would do it. You know, I'll do this all day sitting. You know, can we have dinner? You have to dinner with me afterwards? And she said she would. That was like the deal. I'll do this 12-hour sitting by myself, and then we'll have dinner together to celebrate it. So I did. I did the sitting for the day, and when it's time to go out to dinner, she says to me, is it okay if Sensei comes with us? I was thrilled. You know. Most of my meetings with Bernie at that point were, you know, kind of brief interviews. The chance to go out and have dinner with them was a treat. So we go out to dinner, and I'm like a little kid, you know, in a candy store kind of thing. That I'm here with these two teachers, and I don't know that I mean, I must have spoken because I was an adult at the time, and I must have, you know, given some indication of being able to order at the restaurant and things like that. But basically, I listened to them talk, and they were talking about sort of the next steps in that Bernie envisioned for Jishu on this teacher path that she was on. And that was a long time ago when we were having this dinner, and Mayazumi Roshi was still alive, and the relationship between Mayazumi and his successors, and Bernie was his most important and first successor, between them and Japan, Minnesota, second Japan, was very important. It was very important to Miyazumi, so it was very important to Bernie. And they're talking about the final steps on Jishu's training path, and the step after her getting transmission and becoming sensei would be for her to become the abbot of ZCNY. And Bernie was ready to step out of being the abbot and to do other things and let Jishu basically run that temple, that training center. And Bernie says to Jishu at dinner, so who is going to be your first shuso? The shuso is it's like a lead student. And it's traditionally done for a 3-month training period, linking back to Shakyamuni's practice in India, where the monks would stop wandering during the rainy season in order to not step on the worms who came out in the rain. So they would stay in one place, and Shakyamuni and some of the other teachers would teach. And that training period became institutionalized in Zen. And there would be a person who would be the head trainee for one of these 3-month periods, and that person in Japan is called the shuso. And it turns out that when you become an abbot, the final thing that you do in the Soto tradition of becoming an abbot is you supervise your first shuso. And this all gets recorded in Japan. So in this book in Japan at the Soto sect, in part of the documents of becoming an abbot, it records who the first shuso is. Jishu had a couple of ideas of some senior students that she was working with who she was thinking you might be her first shuso. And Bernie says no, because they're not monks, not priests. And while that doesn't mean much in the Zen community of New York or in ZCLA, where there have been many lay shusos, in Japan, in the Soto sect, it still makes a big difference. Soto sect in Japan want the first shuso, the one that makes you an abbot. They want that shuso to be a priest. So Jishu's stuck. A couple of days later, I go into my interview with Bernie, and I tell him I have this idea that I could ordain, and I could be Jishu's first shuso. So he says, that's an interesting idea, why don't you tell Jishu? So I leave the interview thing with him. They had a couple of rooms for interviews, and she would be doing interviews at the same time that he would be doing interviews. The way they would do it is people would be in a line in the hall, who were waiting for the interviews, be in a line in the hall outside the interview room. So I came out of the room with Bernie, and I got on the line, the end of the line, for the interview with Jishu. I go in to see her, and I tell her this story. She says, so why do you want to ordain? I explained to her that I want to help. That this is important to Bernie and it's important to her, and she needs someone to be the first shuso, and I would be honored to do that. And she says, no, that's not a good reason to ordain. You can't ordain to help somebody else out. I don't know what to say. Just bow and leave, you know? And a couple of weeks later, I go in for an interview with her again, and she says, I don't know, she must ask me something to find out if what I'm thinking about this ordaining and shuso deal, because I'm sure I didn't go in and ask again. So. Felt enough rejected, I guess, that I wasn't going to ask a second time. I was younger then. You know, now I'd be more persistent, but I was younger then. I'm not going to ask anybody to marry me twice. I'm not going to make that kind of offer again. So she asked me, I guess, if that was something I was still considering, and I guess I said yes. I must have said yes. And she says that she's thought about it. It's okay. That I could do it. And what she explained was that what I thought was my intention in ordaining didn't really make any difference. That what we think of our intentions really are stories that we make up in our minds, they're stories. And I'm making up a story about I'm making up a story about doing this. And we tend to think of these, you know, motives and intentions as things which cause our behavior. And that's a story. There is no motive out there that's coming along, smacking the ball, and the ball sails away. We're just kind of going through our life, and we fly off in one direction or another, and somebody says, "Why did you do that?" And you make up a story. You may believe the story, or you may know that you're making up a story. But it's a story just the same, whether you know it or not. What you do counts. Why you think you do it, not so important. There's a story, could have been about me and Jishu, but it's about some long ago monk in Shakyamuni, but it's the same story. It's the rainy season, they're in this camp, in this grove or something, you know, and this drunk shows up. "Hey, everybody. Hey, how are y'all doing? Hey, monk, shave my head." So some of the monks go running over to Shakyamuni and say, "You know, there's this drunk here, asking to have his head shaved." It means he wants to ordain. So he's saying he wants to ordain. "Make me a monk." Basically they're saying, "You know, we just want to check with you before we throw him out, because obviously this is not a serious religious person here. You know, this is somebody who is, this is really sacrilege. He's making a mockery of our religion." I don't know what the monks all said. You know? And they all had this look, but they all had this look on their face. You know what they were expecting. They were expecting Shakyamuni to say, "Good boys, throw the bum out. You are good boys. I'm very proud of you. You're holding up the faith. Get rid of the bum." And Shakyamuni says, "Shave his head." And they say, "But you know, tomorrow morning, when he wakes up, he's not going to want to be a monk. He's just going to run away. Shave his head. They're not going to argue anymore. They go and shave his head. And sure enough, the next morning, this guy wakes up, goes to wash his face in the pool, sees his reflection, lets out a scream, and goes running from the camp. You see, we told you. What Shakyamuni said was that we don't know what the consequence is of his getting his head, of his head shaving. Something happened in his life, and his reaction right now is to run away screaming. But what difference is this going to make in his life? What series of events this is going to unfold, lead to unfolding? What's going to happen? That we don't know. I don't think I knew that story about Shakyamuni at the time that Jishu said okay. But it's a very important teaching, because we take our intentions so seriously. You know, we make them into something so real and powerful. And we forget that they're only stories. Could you say something like, it's true? Well, what does that mean that it's true? It means something like, if you tell your friends why you did it, they agree with you. They say, yeah. They say, good. You know, they say, I like that story. They don't say that words necessarily, but they're telling you they like your story. So you think, okay, you know, my friends agree, this is true. If you go and you tell everybody, you know, the reason I did this was not to get any personal gain, I just did it because I'm a good person, they say, oh, you're full of baloney. Not so sure. But their story's just the same. We worry a lot about this. The beggar on the street asks for money. We tend to put much more emphasis, not on whether we give the beggar some money or not, but on what our reasons are for giving the money or not giving the money. And if we're pretty happy with ourselves, we tend to make up reasons that we feel good about. Something that makes us feel virtuous or strong or rational or economic, whatever we value. And if we're not feeling so good about ourselves, then we make up reasons that make us feel bad about ourselves. But they're all stories, and they all don't make much difference. You give them money, you don't give them money. You make up a story about what you think he's going to do with the money or what you don't think he's going to do with the money. And that's part of your reason for giving or not giving. It's all a story. Tensions are not so important. Well, they are, but they're still only stories.